This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the last week of September, and this week Nancy Pelosi made it official. Democrats have opened an impeachment inquiry into the president. Virtually all of her caucus has come around, too, and there's now majority support for an impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives. Now, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says the speaker can't just open an inquiry on her own, that the House would have to vote for an inquiry, and so it doesn't really exist, but that may mostly be semantics. The key development this week, in my view, is the House has set itself on the road to impeachment, and that's a road it may finish traveling in as little as 2 months. What changed? Well, we learned about what's in this whistleblower complaint over President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. We saw the transcript of that call with the Ukrainian president from July showing Trump urged that country to open a criminal investigation into his political rival, Joe Biden. And while the memo and the transcript do not show the president making an explicit link between the Bidens and the military aid to Ukraine that he withheld for a time, they do show him asking Zelensky for the, quote, favor, unquote, of a Biden investigation. The whistleblower also alleges the White House tried to conceal the call transcript by improperly loading it onto a computer system for highly classified documents, even though it wasn't highly classified. And of course, there's all the stuff Rudy Giuliani's been up to. We'll talk about all of that in a moment, and later in the show, we'll look at Britain's ongoing political crisis with Tom Nuttall from The Economist. First, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, Liz, this Ukraine news has caused a major shift among congressional Democrats in their views about whether the president should be impeached. Why is this particular offense such a game changer?
I assume that Pelosi was willing to move on this because it's a very clear narrative. There are documents available to the public. The whistleblower, who we now know some details about, thanks to the New York Times, seems to be a credible and neutral source. So I think that for all of those reasons, the Democrats felt ready to move because they felt like it wouldn't be as politically hazardous as moving on some of the more contentious issues.
And Rich, we've seen that that seems to have some that seems to be borne out in public opinion as well. At least we have this morning consult poll showing a significant shift in public support for impeachment, about even rather than being underwater, with a majority of the public not wanting impeachment. Of course, it's always hard to separate out. Did the public opinion move because of the new news, or did public opinion move because the fact that so many Democrats moved sent a signal to Democratic partisans that they should support this? But it seems like one of the key arguments we've seen against impeachment from both Democrats and Republicans, the political argument rather than the substantive argument, basically saying this will be unpopular if you do this. It's not clear that's true anymore.
Yeah, we'll see how the polling looks in a couple weeks when we're a little further into this. But clearly, it's solidified Democratic support for impeachment. There were Democrats still in polling who weren't there yet. Move the numbers in that morning consult poll a little bit among independents and even Republicans, but not by much. Phil Klein of the Washington Examiner has a good piece looking at all the polling, and he thinks what's basically happened is the Democrats have gotten the low-hanging fruit. Voters who are strongly anti-Trump, strongly disapprove of the president, but weren't in favor of impeachment yet are now in favor of impeachment. So that's changed the numbers. I do think it's suggestive whether or not Kevin McCarthy is right about whether Speaker Pelosi can just deem what's already happening an impeachment inquiry under her own power or not. But it's interesting that she's not having a vote. And I imagine it would be a fairly it would be almost entirely a partisan vote, and probably a fairly narrow one, because there are still moderate Democrats in Trump districts who are probably saying, let this cup pass from my lips.
Yeah, Liz, I think there's a couple of reasons Pelosi doesn't want to bring that up for a vote. One is, I think, you know, as Rich notes, that puts some Democrats in an awkward position. But I also think Democrats haven't figured out precisely what they're going to do here. And there's basically a couple of things to decide. One is, do you impeach narrowly over this Ukraine issue, or do you have a broad-ranging inquiry and come up with a long list of grievances with the president, which surely they could come up with? The other question is, how much investigating, how much hearings to do? Now, my view has generally been, we know largely the key facts about these things, in part because the president talks so bizarrely publicly about behaviors that he's being very criticized for and even things that could conceivably be criminal acts. So I don't really think that an inquiry is necessary as an investigative matter to have lots of hearings and that sort of thing. But there is definitely at least a political question about whether you want to go through that process or not. And what is your view about how Democrats should approach that? Because it seems like the emerging view among leadership is basically rip the Band-Aid off, do this as fast as possible, not a lot of hearings. And you're hearing from other people who say either, well, we should milk this, the president did a bunch of bad things, we need to make sure the public hears about it, or who say we need to demonstrate that we were thorough, we were deliberate, we didn't rush to judgment, and that's why we need a bunch of hearings. So is it proper to say, well, you know, this is the start of the inquiry, I said so, and we're going to vote on our articles of impeachment by Thanksgiving?
I actually have come around. I mean, initially, I thought that the short and sweet few hearings approach focused tightly on this Ukraine issue made the most political sense and would also pose the least danger to the unity of the republic. But the more I think about it and the more arguments I've read, I do see the wisdom in a longer inquiry that can be more deliberate, that involves a more broad investigation. And I think that makes a lot of sense because at that point, it's not just about drawing up articles of impeachment and impeaching. It's about fact finding. And it's about resolving in some part this epistemic crisis we're having where we can't get any two Americans to agree on what's actually gone on in this presidency. So I think that actually a large inquiry with a lot of fact finding and a thorough investigation could be more healthy for the republic than a narrow impeachment inquiry.
Do you think it's likely to be effective to that end? I mean, I feel like I've watched a lot of congressional hearings over the last few years, and I don't feel like a lot of them do a lot to fix any, you know, epistemic disagreements. I think partisans tend to come out of them believing the same things they went into the hearings believing.
I mean, I think that's definitely a risk. This is the most we can do towards that end, I would assume.
I think Liz's position is the responsible one. I'm not sure in sheer political terms it's the right one because of just the natural dynamic, unless they're explosive bombshells down the road, is the urgency behind these things. It diminishes over time rather than grows greater. And also, the further you get into it, the focus becomes smaller rather than larger. You'll end up, there'll be all these little side issues that we're not focused now that become really big and distract from the bigger narrative and story that Democrats want to focus on. So if I were Pelosi, I'd want to go fast. I don't think that's I'd prefer to see all the facts and a deliberate development of the record and let the facts fall where they may, one way or the other. But in political terms, I don't think that's the best play for them.
And how should Republicans react to this? I feel like we've seen a little bit of diversity in Republican opinion. I mean, Mitt Romney has been the one loud voice basically talking about how troubling all of this is. We saw Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse basically saying that everyone on both sides is rushing to judgment and we should try to learn more about these things. I mean, if you actually take the Sasse position, I mean, shouldn't you want an impeachment inquiry of the sort that you and Liz are describing, where you go and you try to do fact-finding and try to figure out what's happened? Because I think where most of Republicans in Congress seem to have landed is basically saying, you know, there's nothing here that is significant from an impeachment perspective. Kevin McCarthy basically said, you know, Democrats are still trying to relitigate the 2016 election, even though I think a big part of why public opinion has moved and why Democratic members of the House have moved is that this finally is a scandal about the 2020 election rather than the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like a relitigation. It's about ongoing bad behavior.
Yeah, I would draw a distinction between hearings and fact-finding and an impeachment inquiry. You can do the former without doing the latter. And I think this is improper. I think in contrast to where I was on the Russia story, where I was pretty firm that I didn't think there would be any collusion, and at the end they'd come up empty, I think the fact pattern probably here will grow worse rather than better for the president, but it's just a question of whether it's such a gross abuse of authority that it warrants removing him from office. And my answer to that is no. I think most Republicans, their answer to that is sincerely no. But they're disquieted by this in private. Very few of them besides Romney or Sasse will say it publicly, and just annoyed after the whole Russia thing. he somehow got back into, managed to find another landmine to step on, and in part because he wouldn't listen to or ousted all the people who would have said to him, sir, don't do this because they might impeach you over it. Instead, he had Rudy Giuliani running his Ukrainian policy, saluted smartly over this harebrained scheme, and went out and tried to execute it.
Yeah, I believe this call, it was literally the day after the Mueller testimony, if I recall correctly.
And the way I read that is not that, you know, he felt liberated all of a sudden. I think the feeling was, okay, they came up empty. They dragged us through this for 2 years. Now we're going to find out who is at the bottom of this and turn the tables on them. And, of course, they ended up, in certain respects, turning the tables on themselves.
Well, so Liz, Rich is sort of getting here at a funny thing about this call, which is he doesn't just ask about the Bidens. He asks, he wants them to look for email servers in Ukraine, something to do with CrowdStrike, this firm that was involved in investigating the hack of the DNC server. And it's basically sort of weird fever swamp conspiracies about Ukraine having somehow been behind a lot of the damaging investigative stuff that happened to Donald Trump, basically being behind. If not the framing of Paul Manafort, being behind the process that led to the investigation and conviction of Paul Manafort and a lot of the other things that happened here. And it makes me look at this transcript and think, you know, some of the stuff Trump is asking for, you know, you ask for an investigation of Biden and that's sort of a naked, you know, we'll do this thing that will help me beat this person. But some of the other stuff he's asking for, I mean, they're not going to find the server in Ukraine because it's not there. I don't see what political end it serves for the president to ask the Ukrainians to look around for it. It suggests to me that he actually believes a lot of the conspiracy nonsense that drives the asks he's making here, and that maybe affects the analysis of, you know, does the president think he's acting in the national interest here? Now, if he believes all this stuff is trumped up, then really he's just asking for things that benefit him politically. But if he believes some of the crazy things he's saying about the conspiracies that Ukraine has been involved in, then conceivably you could make a case that he thinks in a bizarre way he is acting in the national interest.
I mean, we're never going to know the answer there. We're going to be permanently in a grove on that one because we can't know the president's state of mind. But as best they can ascertain, he does believe all the conspiracy stuff, and he's not the only one. For the past 3 years, the entire political climate has been besieged by conspiracy-themed thinking on the left and the right. And I think that the reason in the United States so many people believe in conspiracy theories are because there are so many conspiracies. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to blame people for suspecting kind of strange networks of powerful people who are manipulating politics. We've seen that to be true time and time again. As for whether Trump actually believes it, I think it's impossible to know. I think that whether or not he thought he was really acting in the best interest of the country is going to be really difficult to establish. But it would be a good question to enter into consideration in a long, more deliberative hearing.
So the thing about the server is obviously wacky. But if all the call was is we have this investigation going into the sources of the Russian investigation, please talk to my attorney general, in my view, that'd be completely fine. Completely fine. It's just having Rudy mucking around with it, his personal lawyer, who is reckless and himself abides by no norms in his latest iteration, that's the problem.
Well, so let's go back to that then, because Rich, you said that you don't think that what the president did here rises to the level of calling for removal from office. And I guess the question is, if the president is using foreign policy toward Ukraine, which has been strategically important for the U.S., or at least we think it's been strategically important because of the way it relates to our relations with Russia and with Europe more broadly, if he's using that as a tool to serve his political interests or his personal interests, and I think a strong indication of that is having his personal lawyer conduct diplomacy, his personal lawyer who has a stake in the president's personal concerns about things that may have been going on in Ukraine. And again, remember, the president had a campaign manager who went to prison over his business dealings with Ukraine. Isn't that a grave misuse of office to be using public policy toward your personal ends? I mean, what would he have to do for you to say that it warranted removal?
I just don't think in the comparison to past abuses and in light of what came of this, which was nothing, it doesn't warrant partly overturning a presidential election, not entirely overturning it. Obviously, Hillary Clinton wouldn't be president. But it's obviously, you know, it's part of a theme, right? He's all along, we've kind of known this, that he doesn't have a proper view, a proper separation between himself and his own various interests and the official role of the presidency. And I think that counts against him. I think it's something he's legitimately criticized over. I just don't think it warrants his thermonuclear remedy, which, by the way, is going to go nowhere because the chances of getting 20 Senate Republicans is basically non-existent. So he'll be celebrating at the end of it. And then also we do have an election coming up in almost 12 months.
But so I don't understand why the key analysis is about whether he got the thing he was asking for, because it seems to me if you use this tool of U.S. foreign policy, because we're supposed to have other objectives related to our relationship with Ukraine, and it seems to me that if you throw the carrots and sticks around that we have with regard to Ukraine for this personal purpose, even if you don't achieve the personal purpose, it seems to me that you've given up the opportunity to use them for a national interest purpose. So, I think, is sort of the underrated reason why this is really problematic behavior, because the U.S. is supposed to be implementing foreign relations policy toward Ukraine toward some other set of purposes, which the president is disregarding, whether or not he actually succeeds in achieving his personal purposes and his use of them.
Yeah, well, the question was the aid, and it was held up, and that was wrong, but it was also very quickly released under pressure by Congress. But Ken Vogel, who's been one of the leading reporters of the New York Times on this, I'm not sure whether he's right, but he says that the Ukrainians didn't know that the aid was being withheld until late August, and then it was released on September 11th. So you have like a two-week period where the Ukrainians would know this, by that account, know the sword was hanging over their heads. Again, it's not great, but I don't think it warrants impeachment and removal.
I don't know how we could know what the Ukrainians knew when without knowing what Rudy Giuliani was telling them, but I don't know. Maybe that's something that we'll learn more about in the process of hearings here. Liz, to close out this particular impeachment discussion, I want to ask you one thing we've talked about a few times, and when I have been less inclined toward impeachment than I am now with this new news, is that I think people don't always ask themselves the question, what is the strategic objective of impeaching the president? So to Rich's point, I think he's right. The Senate will not remove the president even over this, absent some very strange set of new facts that we might learn that I don't expect to learn. So what would Democrats achieve through an impeachment of the president over this issue?
Yeah, I don't expect the removal of Trump either. And even if that did happen, it would only mean the installation of Pence, which wouldn't necessarily be much better where Democrats are concerned. I think that the goal of impeachment at this point is, you know, in the most good faith, fact-finding, establishing the real story of what's been going on, if not only with this Ukraine situation, then in general with the Trump presidency, where there's been so much obfuscation. And then I think the other reason is to act in the best interest of the republic, to act responsibly toward the Constitution. That's the reasoning Pelosi gave, and I think that's the best reasoning they have. And then, you know, the more cynical reasoning would be to damage Republicans in the upcoming election. I worry that could backfire in the same way the Kavanaugh proceedings appeared to in some races.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the act in the best interests of the republic, isn't that assuming the conclusion that impeachment is the best interest of the republic? I mean, I hear people throw around the word accountability. You have to show that there's accountability for these sorts of actions. It's not clear to me that an impeachment that doesn't lead to removal is accountability.
Well, I mean, the proceedings themselves, I'm thinking of, are more important almost than the outcome. I think that is the mindset Democrats should go into it with. I think that if there are questions like these about a president's conduct, they need to be investigated. And that investigation itself, regardless of the outcome, is important for the health of our democracy. It's important to establish transparency. It's important for leaders to realize that there will be real investigations into their conduct and not just mouthing about it on talk news.
Well, I think the case for it also would be, and again, I'm opposed, but would be, you know, it'll be in the third or fourth sentence of his Wikipedia entry, right, for all time, even if he's not removed. This would be a black mark. And also, he really doesn't want it to happen. And there's been some speculation among conservative pundits he's really wanted to be impeached. Completely untrue. You obviously see it in how he's reacted to this. I'm reliably informed. People talk to him all the time. He hates this. He doesn't want it to happen. So I think that would be the case. It's just that you're putting down a marker. But there are also other prudential calculations. And if you believe that Liz is right, it actually might help him get reelected. You're just hurting your ultimate cause.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing to me. I agree with you, Rich. I definitely think the president doesn't want to be impeached. I think it's a separate question from whether it's in his political best interest to be impeached, because I think I can easily imagine that the president would benefit from being impeached but still not want it because it would be right. So bad for his ego, his right. vanity, et cetera. But I'm trying to game through what this means for the election, because I think one thing is that, you know, as bad as this scandal is for the president, I think it's arguably even worse for Joe Biden because it just so much raises the salience of Hunter Biden's work in Ukraine. And while I think there's no plausible reason why there would be a criminal investigation about it, it does certainly look to me like Hunter Biden was making $50,000 a month without obvious marketable skills that one would pay him that for, at least in some months, because he was trading on his father's name and his proximity to influential Democratic politicians in the United States. So I don't know, Liz. I mean, this happens at the same time that we're seeing this significant polling surge for Elizabeth Warren. What does this mean for the Democratic primary? Is this a problem politically for Biden in the primary?
It should be. I mean, it's a gift to Warren because she's run such an emphatic anti-corruption campaign, and I think a boost to Sanders as well, though obviously Warren is jumping in the polls. I mean, you know, $50,000 a month to sit on a board is nearly what I make in a year. I certainly don't make double that. And I think a lot of people are going to really struggle with that as the narrative emerges. And looking into this in impeachment proceedings would certainly mean a tighter focus on what was going on with Biden as we suss that out. I think Democrats want to avoid that. I think the quick move on impeachment was in part motivated by an interest in avoiding a prolonged media consideration of what was really going on with Hunter Biden. But it stinks, and there's no avoiding that.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about the whistleblower. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. President Trump is not happy about the whistleblower who filed the memo accusing him of wrongdoing in his dealings with Ukraine. On Thursday, Trump vented about the whistleblower at a private event with American diplomats. A recording of what he said was sent to the LA Times. Trump noted the whistleblower's knowledge of his call with Volodymyr Zelensky was secondhand. The whistleblower did not listen to the call directly. And he went on to complain about whatever parties told the whistleblower about the conversation.
Who's the person who gave the whistleblower the information? Because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? With spies and treason. Right? We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
Obviously, that's a reference to the death penalty. So far, the whistleblower's identity is not publicly known. The acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, even told a congressional committee on Thursday he doesn't know who the whistleblower is. He also said the whistleblower followed all the proper protocols, and he's been taking steps to reinsure his workforce in the intelligence community that whistleblowers will be protected. But the New York Times has reported some information about the whistleblower's identity, that he's a CIA officer who was formerly posted to the White House. And obviously, with more information coming out about the whistleblower, people are worried about how he or she, the New York Times says it's he, may be retaliated against. We're joined now by Bradley Moss. Brad is a lawyer specializing in national security and whistleblower issues. Brad is also a partner at the D.C. law office of Mark Zaid, which is representing the whistleblower in the news this week. Hi, Brad. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. How you doing, Josh?
I'm good. Thank you. So how concerned are you about these specific comments from the president?
Sure. I mean, this is very disturbing to hear, but this is also very common for Donald Trump. So just to be clear, the whistleblower complied with the law, and you don't have to take my word for it. You can just listen to what the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community and the DNI in testimony yesterday said. This person acted in good faith. They complied with the law, and they have not gone public. They have not responded to any of these smears. But the president is waging now a political war to try to undermine and discredit not only the context of the allegations, but the person who brought them forward in the first place. And also to be, you know, to address, you know, one of the clips you brought up in the intro, the people who provided information to the whistleblower, those individuals arguably could be subject to termination and loss of their clearance because they improperly shared information. That's fine. That's understood. They're not protected by the whistleblower statute. But to talk about them as spies and bringing up treason issue is just disgusting and despicable. But sadly, it has become par for the course with this president.
Are we sure that the sharing of information was improper? I mean, I know that these calls and the content of these calls, there's a lot of people at the CIA, at the State Department, who have a relevant work purpose to know about what is said in these calls. Do we know whether the whistleblower learned about this in the ordinary course of his work, or was it, as you seem to be suggesting here, definitely improper for the whistleblower to have been told?
I'll say from the way that it has been described in the complaint and what we have heard so far in the media, I would be willing to believe and erring on the side of, yeah, probably they provided information beyond what they were supposed to be providing to this particular individual, which doesn't mean anything improper necessarily from a legal or criminal standpoint. Some of this may have been people who, you know, if they were in fact White House employees, recognized they could not raise their concerns to anyone. They're not encompassed by this statute, the whistleblower, the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act. It does not apply to White House staff, but they had a colleague who could file a proper complaint. It didn't mean they had, you know, they were part of a deep state coup against the president. It didn't mean that they were looking to take him down, but they had concerns about what they had observed, and they wanted to make sure it was addressed properly within authorized and legal channels. And that's why we have those statutes, so that people don't go running to the media and disseminate the classified information, which now, unfortunately, has started to leak out from various sources.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, one thing I've been hearing commentators saying, as we've seen both the New York Times reporting some information about the identity of the whistleblower and the president making these implied threats, is basically, see, this is why people don't go through the official whistleblower channels. They're just going to screw you over anyway. But it's not clear to me that's what's happened here, at least not yet. The whistleblower, first of all, seems to have had his desired effect, that Congress has been alerted to the president's behavior. And while it remains to be seen exactly what's going to happen to the whistleblower, he certainly seems to be in a better position than Edward Snowden, for example, and that is attributable to him following the law.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think the New York Times was being irresponsible in reporting the details that they did have. Like you said, they haven't released the whistleblower's identity. They might have made him more identifiable. My sense is that when the identity of the whistleblower comes out, it won't be news to the Trump administration. They probably already have a pretty good idea of who it had to have been. So in that sense, the whistleblower protections so far seem to have worked, if there have been no repercussions against the individual so far. But I do think it calls into question the way that we have dealt with other whistleblowers like Reality Winner and Edward Snowden.
Brad, what would you say about that?
Yeah, well, with Reality Winner and Edward Snowden, of course, they didn't utilize the recognized and the proper channels. And, you know, I've seen Thomas Drake's name thrown around. Thomas Drake did make some protected disclosures for which he ultimately was not prosecuted for because he wouldn't have been able to. But what they did go after him for was his leaks.
I'm sorry, remind our listeners who Thomas Drake is.
Sure. So Thomas Drake was an NSA whistleblower way back in the early years, right after 9/11, when the NSA was trying to construct a far broader set of intelligence collection programs that were far in expanse of what we had previously done, as we were trying to respond to this brand new threat. And he was a senior NSA executive with longtime service in the government, and he raised concerns initially internally about what he viewed as unlawful mechanisms or unlawful methods in which this program was being applied. It was scooping up too much private data of American citizens without proper warrants, and it needed to be reined in. And when it didn't find its desired effect internally, he started communicating with a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. He was eventually prosecuted. The case was originally claiming that what he provided to the Baltimore Sun was classified. That case fell apart in the end. He pled guilty to a misdemeanor. But when people throw out his name as saying, look, he went, you know, in through internal channels and he got prosecuted. Yes, but it wasn't for what he did internally. It was for how he went to the press. And that is the key distinction here. And you mentioned it earlier. This person got, you know, they reported their concern. They still remain anonymous. They're still able to go to work to the extent that they still work for the government. And no one knows who they are. And now it's up to the political parties, and by parties I mean the two branches of government, the executive and the legislative, to sort out what, if anything, has to be done here. And that's how this process is designed.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, to that point, there's this dissonance where you have Joseph McGuire, who again is the person who decided initially that the legal standards did not require him to share this with Congress. And he did a number of things that upset Democrats in Congress, basically saying, you know, well, I had to protect executive privilege interests and that sort of thing. But Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, still said that the whistleblower had behaved properly and had followed all the appropriate processes. And so when you have the president casting aspersions on the whistleblower and other people who had been in the chain of information that led to the whistleblower's memo. I mean, again, is that, you know, it looks to me like witness tampering. These people are going to be called before Congress. Why is that not a thing that you could properly impeach a president over?
I don't know about that. It just seems inherent to this kind of process, which is political at its root, that the one side's going to attack the sources of the other side. I mean, it happened in the Clinton impeachment. Every woman who popped up, or every advocate for a woman who popped up, everyone on the other side was raked through the coals. And there's a great Hamilton quote that was circulating on Twitter from the Federalist Papers about how impeachment works. And he basically said, "What you know, the great risk or the tendency will be just everyone digs in on the basis of their prior partisan attachments." So I don't think that's unusual. I will say there's
but
been
suggesting that
of,
people ought to be killed is pretty unusual.
Oh, yeah. No,
right?
Of course. I mean, it's ridiculous and you shouldn't say it. I just consistency demands that I say this is the way it should happen. Snowden, I thought, should have gone through the whistleblower process. This guy went through the whistleblower process. I believe the strict reading of the legalities on the part of McGuire and the OLC at the Justice Department were correct. So I think everyone was playing it by the book here, and it was much better than a whistleblower, you know, going directly to the press or using other means. He tried to go through the process as it's set up and supposed to work.
Brad, was McGuire playing it by the book? I mean, some of these questions are sort of moot now because the president decided to make all this public. But obviously, you had a lot of Democrats in Congress who were saying that McGuire and the Office of National Intelligence had a legal obligation to hand this whistleblower memo over to Congress, which they were not making good on. Who had the best of that argument? Was McGuire right to be holding on to it for certain reasons?
So as much as I hate to say it, I think the government's argument is a non-frivolous one. They had a legitimate claim, not necessarily on privilege, but the jurisdictional scope of the statute. The way the mandatory referral process was set up in the ICWPA, the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act, is that the DNI has to forward the complaint on to the Intelligence Committee after the IG has deemed it credible, it's an urgent concern, but it only if it qualifies as the urgent concern in the sense that it falls within the scope of the DNI's supervision. And so the problem that McGuire, who'd been on the job for like 3 days when this landed on his desk, was that the president's not under his supervision. The president is his boss. And so there was a question of whether or not this statute, for purposes of this particular jurisdictional question, could apply to a complaint against the president, him or herself. And that's why he went to DOJ. I understand why he did it. I disagree in the end from a policy standpoint on the decision not to originally forward it. But as a legal matter, if this had played out in the courts, if they had tried to hold on to it, they may have had the best of that argument.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's in the memo other than this July 25th call itself? There's this allegation, basically, that people in the White House, after this call happened and after people realized how it could be embarrassing or even incriminating or they were concerned that it would get out, that they ended up loading it into a computer system that's supposed to be for highly classified material. And the memo basically alleges that is improper to do. How bound is the White House on that? Because, my understanding is these calls, their transcripts are are generally not supposed to become public. Does the White House not have a legitimate interest in trying to prevent the dissemination of it, and is loading it on that computer system an improper way to try to prevent dissemination?
So it's improper, as I would say, from a policy standpoint, not necessarily from a legal one. And the reason here, and as you know, you think about that old quote from the Watergate era, it's the cover-up, not the crime. The problem that they had here was the White House officials, and particularly it seems the lawyers, were so concerned about what the president was saying on these calls. And it's according to the complaint, there's more than one with other leaders. It's not just this transcript that was getting put on this code word classified storage system. But they were so freaked out about what Trump was saying and how it could potentially implicate criminal laws that they were taking it off the normal system so that, you know, where other cabinet officials could access it, where various subordinate national security officials could access it so they could do their job. So they were aware of what anything the president may have said that they may have to take in consideration when representing the United States government in their tasks. They had taken it off that system and stuck it in to a system that's designed for only code word classified, most highly sensitive national security secrets where almost no one could get to it. And the question becomes, if there was nothing to any of this, why on earth are you, you know, hiding it in the equivalent of the National Enquirer's vault? What is it you're so afraid of? And so again, you know, with everything else, what was it that they saw in this? What is it in the other transcripts? And did the president, was this a pattern and practice of this president trying to abuse his authority for personal political gain?
It's funny, Rich, what Brad describes there, in addition to the question of impropriety of concealing this transcript on this computer system, is that it would seem to exacerbate an issue that is made clear in this memo, which is that the U.S. is supposed to have one foreign policy toward Ukraine, and we have more than one. We have one that's being conducted officially by the State Department and other organs of the government, and we have another one that's being conducted by Rudy Giuliani and perhaps intermittently by the president through these phone calls. And so one of the interesting parts of this narrative has been basically sort of more normal parts of our diplomatic apparatus trying to find ways to deal with the fact that Rudy Giuliani is apparently inserting himself in Ukrainian diplomacy, trying to give instructions as though he were an official representative of the U.S. government, which seems like a significant problem.
Yeah, well, everyone knew, at least all the professionals knew it was a problem at the time. According to reporting, they didn't want this call with the president of Ukraine to take place because they were worried that the president would bring this up and say inappropriate things. And there are 12 people on the call, you know, 10 of whom were probably freaked out by what was said and really concerned about what was said. I want to learn more about how this process works and whether it, you know, happened with other transcripts of calls, you know, going on this more secure server, but it's certainly a sign that everyone realized it's something the president shouldn't have done. And again, if John Bolton had been running his Ukraine policy, if Mike Pompeo had been running his Ukraine policy, this never would have happened. But Rudy Giuliani was.
I mean, it's funny, Liz, because I mean, so much of this flows from how we have this presidential system where all of the foreign policy power is vested directly in the president, and it seems like that's a really inappropriate system for Donald Trump. I'm not sure whether we're learning anything about the appropriateness of that system in general going forward with more normal presidents, and so I'm not sure how to feel about things that undermine that. I mean, where you have, you know, other parts of the State Department apparatus going around basically trying to clean up messes, essentially trying to implement a different policy than the president himself would seek to implement.
Right. And, you know, it's up to the individual whether they think that's a good thing in this particular case or not. But I think the wider systemic point that you raise is the right one, that so much of our foreign policy is dictated by decisions that are not democratically decided, right? I mean, the president is elected by the people, so there's a democratic element there. But ideally, because foreign policy is so impactful and has such a major effect on how the world functions, I think that we should, you know, have greater control over it as a democracy. And you would hope to see Congress have a bigger role in foreign policy than they currently do.
Brad, are we ever going to learn what becomes of this whistleblower? I mean, obviously, if they're publicly identified, then we will. But suppose that the whistleblower is not. I mean, the law is supposed to protect them from retaliation and such. And as you know, the concerns that people have raised, that people are not going to want to use official whistleblower channels in the future, if things go basically as they are supposed to and the whistleblower is protected, will the public know about that?
No. you know, and more or less, I would hope this person gets to become essentially the equivalent of Deep Throat, where people spend generations trying to figure out who it could have been. And there's books and movies and documentaries, but you don't actually learn about it to that person's, you know, final days on this earth. Unless someone else's this person, then, or unless the whistleblower him or herself chooses to come forward, no one should really have any knowledge of who they are, nor have any interest, because the whistleblower is not the story. The substance of what this person raised was the story, and now it's up to the political branches to figure out if it matters.
Bradley Moss is a lawyer specializing in national security litigation. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, anytime.
Still with me are, on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters, or maybe 280, to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from Will Kane, who tweeted about the Carson King affair. Carson King briefly attained fame for holding up a sign asking for beer money during an ESPN show. People showered him with money. He decided to give it to a children's hospital and raised a ton of money for the children's hospital. This would have seemed to feel like a feel-good story, but since it's 2019, it's ended in tears. King had to apologize for offensive tweets that were unearthed by a Des Moines Register reporter, who in turn was fired for offensive tweets in his past as well. And Will tweeted about this: the Des Moines Register has canceled the reporter who tried to cancel the philanthropist Carson King, not because he showed horrific news judgment, but because he too had bad tweets in his past. Something tells me they're missing the point.
Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
From Levi Gibeon: for my own mental health, I'm going to scale back my time on Twitter to only 9 hours a day. Sounds about right.
My tweet of the week comes from MSNBC's Steve Kornacki. He tweets about a new National Democratic primary poll. He says, Quinnipiac is the second straight national poll to show Warren moving into second place among black voters. She's at 19% in this one to 40% for Biden. This could bode well for her chances to break Biden's South Carolina firewall if she can win in Iowa and New Hampshire, unquote. Now, I just want to note, I said a couple of weeks ago on this show that I was skeptical about this, that I was watching Warren rise, but I still wasn't seeing the necessary improvement with black voters that would allow her to close the deal in a national Democratic primary. This is some evidence that that may be starting to change. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Tom Nuttall of The Economist to talk about Britain. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And we're joined now by Tom Nuttall, who is Berlin bureau chief for The Economist. Hello, Tom.
Hi there.
So, Tom, we mostly want to talk with you about Britain and its maybe impending departure from the European Union. But before we get to that, can I ask you about Germany? Because Germany has had a role in this U.S.-Ukraine scandal. In that call transcript that President Trump decided to release, we know one thing he said to Volodymyr Zelensky was that German Chancellor Angela Merkel talks Ukraine, but that Germany doesn't actually do anything for Ukraine. How is the story being received over there in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, people have noticed that, and it slots into a pattern, I think. You might remember at a NATO summit a year or two ago, Donald Trump very publicly castigated the Germans for their energy policy while he was talking to Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, live. And so there does seem to be a sort of a sense that this is a habit for Donald Trump, not only on matters Russia-related, also obviously on trade, defense, and all the rest of it. So yes, it was noticed, but I don't think it was a particular surprise for anyone here to see the president singling out the chancellor like that.
But does the president actually have a point that there's a key issue of alignment between the U.S. and Ukraine, where Germany's on the other side? Is this pipeline that's under construction between Russia and Germany, Nord Stream 2, that would basically allow the Russians to get gas to Germany by bypassing Ukraine? The Ukrainians are worried that this interferes with their energy security. So this is an issue where basically we're on one side of it with Ukraine, in part because we would like to sell natural gas into Europe. And then Germany's interests actually seem to be more aligned with Russia's, right?
On that particular issue, absolutely right. And the Ukrainians are very unhappy with the Germans over Nord Stream 2. And it's rather strange because overall, Angela Merkel has been extremely tough on Russia when it comes to Ukraine. She is the one who's held the line inside the European Union on sanctions for Russia, for example, ever since they were first imposed after the annexation of Crimea. But when it comes to this this issue around Nord Stream 2, the pipeline that you're describing, the German government is kind of schizophrenic on this, because on the one hand, they will say, we will do everything we can to guarantee Ukraine's security and sovereignty. And when you start talking to them about energy, it's all, oh, well, this is a commercial project. It doesn't have geopolitical implications. There's no reason for a government to get involved in it. They have adjusted that line marginally over the last couple of years, but the project is still going ahead with German support. And while, in my view, American concerns over this, particularly under this administration, have not always necessarily been informed by entirely altruistic concerns, as you say, they're rather keen to sell their natural gas over here. The concerns, to be fair, they also predate the Trump administration. They go back to the Obama administration as well. So overall, American concerns over Nord Stream 2, I think, are fully justified. And I think the German government deserves the heat that has taken over that.
Okay, let's turn to Britain, which arguably has had an even weirder couple of weeks in politics than the U.S. has. Britain is supposed to leave the EU by October 31. Prime Minister Boris Johnson very much wants to meet that deadline, and one of the steps he took toward that was proroguing Parliament, which is to say dismissing it for a few weeks so it couldn't force more votes that he would lose about the European Union. Parliament has already voted to force Johnson to request an extension of the withdrawal deadline if there isn't an agreement on withdrawal terms by Halloween, which there is very unlikely to be. That is, Johnson is not allowed to do a so-called hard Brexit on October 31st. But Johnson has threatened that he might defy that law and do it anyway. And now Britain's highest court has said that he violated the Constitution by sending Parliament away, so it came back promptly and everyone's very angry with each other. Tom, what's going to happen here in the next 5 weeks or so?
I hate to disappoint you, but it's absolutely impossible to answer that question. There's a lot of moving parts here. You just described most of them very succinctly. The timeline is this. So Parliament, as you said, has been recalled after this extraordinary Supreme Court decision a few days ago. That doesn't necessarily move the needle very much when it comes to Brexit, because, as you said, the Parliament, before the prorogation took effect, it was already able to pass this law that says that if Boris Johnson hasn't secured a deal by the European summit, which takes place on October the 17th, then by October the 19th, he must, by law, request a further extension to the Brexit deadline from the EU. And by the way, the EU has to unilaterally agree to grant that extension. Now, what's happening now is that Boris Johnson, the government, says that that Britain will be leaving on October the 31st, do or die, to use his phrase. They also say that they will obey the law. Now, those two statements look contradictory. And the question now is, how are they going to manage to do both of those things? What seems to be going on, no one knows, but what seems to be going on is that the government is trying to figure out how it can find some sort of loophole in this legislation, which is very peculiar, by the way, the Parliament ordering the government to do such and such in an international negotiation, that they'll be looking for some sort of loophole that means that they can somehow both follow the provisions of the law while also ensuring that we leave on October the 31st. And what I think is probably going to happen, assuming that we don't get a deal next month, and I think that that's unlikely, is that the government's going to find some sort of legal wheeze to get around this. And once again, we're going to find ourselves back in court. And this feeds into a growing sense here, and for some people, a growing concern that our courts, rather like in the US, are becoming sort of weaponized by politicians to conduct their debates, because Parliament, the normal sort of tribune for politics, isn't functioning as it should, or at least it's not. Its relationship to the government is becoming warped and distorted, and therefore courts might be asked to rule on this.
Yeah, that does seem like a little bit of an American export. Rich, it's funny with the, you know, Boris Johnson sort of rooting around there trying to find a way to thread this needle. There's been a sense through this whole process, as Johnson got himself into position to be prime minister, that he's acting like he has some sort of secret plan for a bunch of things. Is he smarter than he looks? Because it looks to me like he's just sort of bumbling around here and does not have any sort of secret plan, and something extremely chaotic is about to happen in Britain. Am I wrong to have that impression, Rich?
Well, I think he's quite a shrewd guy. It's just a difficult verging on impossible situation where, because of various changes in how the British political system operates, what would have been one of the advantages, you know, as we noted, we talked about this months ago, that, you know, if you have a parliamentary majority, you can pass things through Parliament, no longer applies. And Boris Johnson basically does not have a workable majority in Parliament, but can't hold an election. And the Supreme Court thing, the whole is, you know, Tom or anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, the whole point of the British system is Parliament sovereign. So the idea that you have a court that's a creature of Parliament superimposing itself above Parliament and taking position on what's inherently a political issue, this proroguing, is just bizarre and just a sign that Brexit and the contention over it is kind of breaking the unwritten British Constitution.
Liz, I mean, as Rich notes there, Johnson does not have a parliamentary majority. He came in with a very thin one, and then he kicked out a bunch of members of his own party for not supporting him on Brexit. The polls remain very closely divided on this, and there's a wide variety of different options about what you could do, none of which has a clear majority. It feels like this should be an opportunity for Johnson's opposition to capitalize on the unpopularity of what he has been doing. And a hard Brexit would be very unpopular. The problem, as I look at the polling over there, is basically you have this split on the left, that you have this leftist leader of Labour, Jeremy Corbyn, and there are some voters who are perhaps more affluent voters in London or other major cities who are strongly pro-European, don't find Corbyn to be pro-European enough, maybe find him to be too far left on economics. They're being drawn away toward the Liberal Democratic Party. And then you also have more working class voters in the traditional base of Labour who are drawn to the Conservatives for cultural reasons or because they're strongly anti-European. And so it seems to me that this is an argument against the sort of the Bernie Sanders idea that you can build a broad populist left base for a more left-wing economic agenda, that basically you're going to get splits around other issues and you're not going to be able to there isn't sort of a silent majority waiting out there for somebody like Jeremy Corbyn to lead them into the socialist revolution.
Well, the United Kingdom is different than the United States. I think that their institutions are different than ours in a way that poses us in a better position to build a left. For instance, they actually have a left, and they also have lots of institutions that our left is trying to build, like the NHS and other welfare programs. So I think those are potentially unifying economic projects. It's just that they're already accomplished in the United Kingdom, so it's not as much of a rallying point, although they do rally around preserving the NHS versus privatizing it. There's never going to be 100% left unity. Even people who do agree on vast economic issues, as you point out, split up along others. The question is that, you know, in important elections or on important points, can you get the left to come together and vote leftist politicians into power? I think that's possible. I mean, I think you're seeing a big jump for Elizabeth Warren, and she's pushing a very populist message. I don't think it's going to happen 100% of the time. I think conditions have to be right, and I think there will always be disunity on the left. But I don't think that Corbyn's struggles signify a major problem for the left.
Yeah, Tom, the expectation is there'll be an election pretty soon over there, is my understanding, and that the opposition parties are trying to make sure it comes after October 31st, I guess, in part to make sure this law works, and in part because the polling shows that if Boris Johnson fails to take Britain out of the EU by October 31st, a lot of people who might normally vote for his Conservative Party will vote for another party called the Brexit Party to try to really force a Brexit. You could get a weird four-way split result in this election among four different parties. Is there any sense that, you know, if there's another election that is an implicit referendum on how to proceed on Brexit, it kind of looks like you might get another completely inconclusive result, and it's not clear what the government would do after that?
Exactly right. The polls are extremely difficult to read right now. As you say, we do have a four-way split. It's not an even four-way split. The Conservative Party generally has a substantial lead. But you were asking earlier, does Boris Johnson have a master plan? And to the extent that there is a master plan, what it seems to be is to squash the Brexit Party, which, as its name suggests, is a single-issue party devoted to taking us out of the EU ideally without any sort of deal at all, to squash them and to secure a majority on the basis that you're going to get us out of the EU as soon as possible. Now, the jury, to put it mildly, is very much out on whether that strategy is working, but that seems to be the best way to explain some of the extraordinary ways in which this government has been behaving ever since Boris Johnson came to office. When it comes to an election, it's tricky to make forecasts because some of that Brexit Party vote has been squeezed by the Conservative Party, but there seems to be a very substantial part of it that's resilient to it. And the reason for that is that in the north of England, in traditional working class places where you've traditionally had a very large vote for the Labour Party, those voters who are pro-Brexit, who therefore are shifting away from the Labour Party, a lot of them in their bones, in their DNA, they can never vote Conservative. And so they have this party that's ready made for them, the Brexit Party. That might represent a lid on the possible strategy that the Conservative Party seem to be pursuing. If you're on the Remain side, then you have the Liberal Democrats, who you mentioned, who were as unequivocally pro-Remain as it can possibly be. The Labour Party is not quite clear, but they're pushing for another referendum. So how these various cross-cutting dynamics interplay, interact with one another in the run-up to an election campaign is hard enough to predict as it is. And that's before we know what's going to happen next month and whether or not the Conservative Party's strategy of taking us out and somehow getting around this law is going to work or not. That's why it's impossibly difficult to make predictions about how this is going to play out.
Tom Nuttall is Berlin bureau chief at The Economist. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The left has a fondness for celebrity spokeschildren for its causes. The latest example is 16-year-old Swedish girl Greta Thunberg, who recently sailed across the Atlantic to the U.S. because she opposes jet travel and is being treated as a great oracle on climate change, even though she says nothing different than the most hysterical adult activists. At a speech at the U.N. this week, she bitterly complained that she had said she should be back at school instead of engaging in high-profile climate advocacy. Actually, there's a very easy solution to that complaint.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Everybody seems really excited about impeachment on the left. I understand why. We've been going round and round about it for what feels like many, many years now, although it's only been three approximately. But I wouldn't get too excited about impeachment, not because it's not going to happen, it very well may, and not because there won't be damning facts in the inquiry. There almost certainly will be. But because of what it could do to the republic, polarization gets worse and worse. Civil unrest becomes more and more likely, and I do sincerely worry about that. So take it easy.
For my rant, it appears some officials at the Democratic National Committee listened to these rants. Even though 12 candidates have unfortunately qualified for the October Democratic presidential debate, the DNC and CNN have nonetheless announced they will subject us to just one debate night. Thank you. Now, please follow through on the rest of my suggestion. Do not let Tom Steyer talk. The rules only say you have to let him on stage, not that you have to let him talk. You could put him in an isolation booth, like they used to do on 21, and then just, once he's in the booth, switch his microphone off. Again, I ask, who would complain? That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Bradley Moss, and Tom Nuttall. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Tadam Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.